Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
Today on Maine Calling, the rule of law and what's before the Supreme Court. Since taking office in January, President Trump has issued a blizzard of executive orders, and most of them are being challenged in court. In fact, courts have paused more than 150 of the Trump administration's initiatives so far. One of the big questions of our day, what do these court orders mean on the ground? Will they be followed? And if not, what then? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Many people are worried about the rule of law in America right now, including Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts and dozens of Maine lawyers who recently signed a letter supporting the fundamental principles of our legal system. We'll talk with legal scholars about these big questions and the future of democracy. Maine Calling is just ahead. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It may seem like a simple concept, following the law, but current events, both in Maine and at the national level, reveal that following the law isn't necessarily so straightforward. Today, a panel of legal experts will help us understand this principle, the rule of law, and the role that the current U.S. Supreme Court justices play in upholding it. Well, joining me for the hour, Dimitri Baum, who is Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law. William Harwood, retired attorney who recently served as Maine's public advocate. He is now leading a group that is organizing Maine lawyers to support the rule of law. And Susan Fonts is an attorney at Berman and Simmons and president of the Maine State Bar Association. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about big legal issues, either here in Maine or before the Supreme Court? Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all so much for joining us today. And I'm going to start and I'll turn to you, Dimitri. The Supreme Court watchers are paying attention to many cases right now because of their potential impact on the future. But the Supreme Court already did issue a ruling that is very relevant here in Maine. Dimitri, tell us about the decision about Representative Laurel Libby and what it means. It's temporary, correct?
Right. Well, thanks for having me here, Jennifer. It's great to be back. Yeah, so the case was basically expedited on what some have called the shadow docket, right? So the case has not been fully briefed, fully argued. It was rushed to the Supreme Court, and the question was whether to grant an injunction to the ban here of Representative Libby's from voting in the legislature, right?
Representative Libby had been censured by the Democratic Speaker of the House for posting a picture of a transgender athlete, and for that has not been able to vote or speak on the House floor. She challenged that. The Supreme Court expedited it, and the Supreme Court has said, we're putting a stay on this. You can speak and vote. Does it have bigger meaning?
Well, at least for now, it's only a temporary stay, and the court eventually could get this case back. And the big question will be, what's the First Amendment implications of a legislature's censure along these lines? There's not a lot of case law of censuring a legislator from speaking. I mean, there have been some cases in American history where somebody wasn't seated based on some findings that they weren't ethical enough to sit in the legislature. But there's potentially a big First Amendment issue that could be resolved if this case made its way back to the Supreme Court.
Mm. And when the Supreme Court issues a stay, is that usually an indication of how they would rule if it comes back to them?
Not necessarily, but there's certainly a factor the court would consider. I think in any case, whether an injunction or a restraining order, the court thinks about the likelihood of prevailing on the merits. So it's likely that it was in the courts, at least for some justices, in their minds.
All right. So, Susan, is this case something that's representative of what people are thinking about when they're thinking about the rule of law in this country and challenges to it? Or is this more of sort of a classic Supreme Court case?
I mean, I guess in terms of sort of procedurally how this case has progressed, it does follow the rule of law in the sense that, you know, I think initially this was at the First Circuit and then it was appealed up to the Supreme Court. So I guess from a lawyer perspective, you know, we would be moving an issue through the courts. And if we thought that a lower court had not decided in a way that we thought the law should have been addressed, then we would appeal it to the next level of the court. And that's what happened here in terms of, I guess, the rule of law.
Okay, and I'm going to back up a little bit because this phrase, the rule of law, is being bandied about a lot right now, but it's not something that has been bandied about a lot for my lifetime, at least. When we say the rule of law, are we talking about the concept that this is a country of governed by laws, not men, or are we talking about something else?
I'll jump in. The way I think of the rule of law, I don't think of the Libby case as being a classic example of how we use that term. We're really talking about the role of the judiciary and the courts in our system of government. And it's the courts who have the final say on disputes and in interpretation of statutes and the Constitution. And that's when we talk about the rule of law, we're talking about the independence of the judiciary and the need for everyone, including the highest offices in Washington, to follow and obey the rulings of the court. And that's really what's at issue here. We are starting to see the Trump administration attacking judges and lawyers and undermining the rule of law.
Okay, yeah, so go ahead, Susan.
Just to tag on to that, it's the idea of using the law and using the court, the judiciary system, to advocate for your positions and to respect those decisions, whether you like them or not.
All right. Well, we do know, and I read recently that as of yesterday, there are 165 challenges to Trump administration executive orders and initiatives. So obviously a lot of people challenging whether or not the administration has the legal authority to do many of the things that it's doing. I want to ask you, Dimitri, is the reason that the Trump administration is able to do this because of the 2024 decision, the Trump versus the U.S., that is this decision that that gave the president immunity from a criminal act, something that is undergirding this sort of blizzard of initiatives that are unprecedented in U.S. history?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think I'd pin it more to a different issue about the growing scope of executive power and use or maybe abuse of executive power, right? I mean, most of these challenges are not really allegations that the president or the administration is engaging in criminal conduct. It's that they're exceeding either the powers delegated to the president or violating some individual rights that are in the Constitution. And so most of these challenges really stem from the fact that there is no Congress anymore to act as a check on the president, right? There's kind of the structure we all learned in Civics 101, that Congress passes a law and the president implements the law. We're not seeing that today, right? Most of these challenges are actions taken by the president without express authorization by Congress, often in the face of Congress, and acting in the face of sometimes decades or centuries of precedent.
All right. And Bill, we mentioned at the top of the show that most lawyers in Maine are organized behind this effort. Tell us about the letter you sent and other initiatives in Maine's legal community.
Yeah, I think what we're finding is a large number of lawyers in Maine and throughout the country are very concerned about where this is headed and the challenges to the rule of law. This idea that the administration may or may not be have to comply with a judicial ruling or may seek the impeachment or may threaten law firms who take unpopular causes against the administration. And so our group reached out and we got 700 lawyers and 100 law firms in Maine, virtually every law firm in Maine, to sign on to a basic statement. And the statement is simply that, I'll just read you that one sentence, our justice system is premised on the principle that all individuals and entities, regardless of their political, social, or economic standing, are entitled to representation. And that's really at the core of it. And that is being jeopardized by some of the actions of this administration.
Susan, of these 165 challenges I mentioned, which are those that you believe are the most important? What are you watching the Supreme Court? What are you watching for as the Supreme Court issues decisions this later this year?
I think the most, the one that I've been following recently is Trump versus Casa, the decision regarding, or sort of this issue about whether or not district courts can issue preliminary, universal preliminary injunctions. This has to do with birthright citizenship, which is a constitutional issue, but it's been appealed on more of a procedural issue. And for me, I guess the reason why I'm following that closely is it seems like the Trump administration is taking a position where they're raising this issue on a procedural level as opposed to a substantive level. And they're making this argument that judges can only make a decision based on the parties before the case, although the executive order obviously has an impact on not just parties who are able to go before the court. And I guess from a lawyer perspective, that raises the issue of, you know, how do people have access to lawyers, you know, to appeal a case, especially to appeal a case all the way up to the Supreme Court. You know, someone needs representation. And because this issue of birthright citizenship can have such a wide range of impact, if the Supreme Court were to rule that universal preliminary injunctions are not permitted, that would have a huge impact on lawyers representing clients who need to have their individual cases work through the court system. And I question whether or not everyone's going to have an access to lawyers. I question whether or not lawyers even have the capability to be able to represent all those people who would need representation. So I guess from a lawyer perspective, from the Maine State Bar Association perspective, that's sort of what I'm thinking about.
Okay. And Bill, what about you? Which of the cases do you believe will have a really important impact on the future of the court system and the democracy?
The ones I'm particularly interested in are these cases where the executive order has sought sanctions against law firms for taking on unpopular clients and unpopular causes. It's really important for the listeners to understand that lawyers and judges are critical to protecting our civil rights and our liberties and our freedoms. And lawyers need to be able to, everyone is entitled to their day in court, and we can't have the federal government seeking to intimidate and punish law firms and for simply standing up for those who are entitled to their day in court. And similarly for the judges, we can't, who have very limited ability to push back and protect themselves. We have to defend them whether we agree with their decision or not. That is the rule of law. So those are the cases that I think are critical to every other civil right and freedom and liberty that we hold so dear. We have to have lawyers who can take those cases, bring them before a judge, and not fear that they're going to be sanctioned by the federal government.
And Dimitri, what would you add to that? What are really significant cases that you're watching right now?
Well, I think both Susan and Bill mentioned some really important ones. And, you know, in Susan's case, I think we've been talking about nationwide injunctions for a long, long time, certainly during the Biden administration. There have been a lot of people on the left who are really concerned about kind of strategic lawsuits being brought in districts with one judge, where that judge can stop the Biden administration from acting. So I think it's a really important issue. You know, another case I've been thinking about is Skirmetti, which is about transgender rights and state legislation kind of banning access to certain medical treatment for transgender individuals.
I think that'll be an interesting one as well. You know, a few years ago, we had the Bostock case, where Justice Gorsuch, of all people, wrote the opinion applying Title VII protections, discrimination based on sex, to transgender individuals. I'm curious to see how the court will treat that decision and apply it to the 14th Amendment to transgender discrimination or the Equal Protection Clause.
And Dimitri, when will we start hearing these? It's pretty soon, right? Hearing these decisions.
Well, right. So Scarametti is certainly going to be decided sometime this year. I think some of the cases that you're mentioning, you know, the 160 plus, some of those are still kind of early in the pipeline. They might take some time to get to the court. But usually we see kind of mid to late June, towards the end of the court's year, is when they decide that kind of major, the most important cases. So I'd expect them towards kind of mid to late June.
We have so much more to talk about, including what happens if the Supreme Court makes a decision and the Trump administration does not follow it. We'd like to hear your questions. What are your questions about this concept of the rule of law? What are you most concerned about as you watch what's happening today? What do you want to push back on? What do you think is okay? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing some recent Supreme Court cases, what's happening with legal issues in Maine, and just broadly the concept of rule of law and whether the basic governmental principles are at risk. My guest today, Bill Harwood, former Maine public advocate who is now helping to organize Maine lawyers to support the rule of law. Susan Fonts, an attorney and president of the Maine State Bar Association, and Dimitri Baum, vice dean and professor at Maine Law. Share your comments and questions. Email us, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Already lots of emails coming in, but feel free to call as well, 1-800-399-3566. Dimitri, I have to say to you, I have read that law school applications are up all over the country, and that including at UMaine, and that the people who are applying are saying they want to be able to make a difference. Is this your experience?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly saw what we call the Trump bump in 2020 as well, right? So we're seeing 2016, right? So we're seeing people, you know, students really interested in making a difference. And people are seeing how important the legal system is, right? The importance of lawyers, the importance of judges. They're seeing basically any issue they care about, whether it's immigration or the environment, tariffs, right? Issues they never thought they cared about, really working their way through the legal system. So almost everything now they can see touches the law, touches lawyers, and touches this process that Susan and Bill have been talking about.
Mm. So I want to get back to that question. And Bill, I'll turn to you for this. And this is the question a lot of people are asking. We've already seen some evidence that this could happen, and some would argue is already happening. What happens when there is an order and it is not followed?
Yeah, this is a great question, Jennifer, and one that a lot of smart people, academic law professors, and are worrying about. Our judicial system does not have a built-in police force in terms of enforcing their orders. We have, going back to the founding principles of our country, back to Chief Justice John Marshall, all accepted this concept that they are the final deciders of the legal disputes, and we all, every one of us, including the President of the United States, must follow those orders. And for the first time, if we end up with a situation in which this administration, for whatever reason, declines to follow those orders, we are now in the middle of a constitutional crisis. It will take the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and all of us, the people, the citizens of this country, to stand up and make it clear that that is not okay, and we will not tolerate anyone flouting or ignoring the orders from the courts of this country.
Susan, we talked earlier about the president who has attacked some law firms that have represented people who he considers his enemies. Do these attacks have a chilling effect on law firms? And do you believe it has a chilling effect on law firms here in Maine and who they accept as clients?
I mean, I think in general, they can have a chilling effect on law firms. It depends on how the law firms want to respond. And we know on a national level, we've seen responses both ways. But, a law firm without clients can exist. And if the executive branch is issuing orders that is affecting their ability to retain clients, just as a matter of business, that puts the law firm at risk. So I understand the sort of the real practical implications of the decisions that have to be made on principle, but also on a business level. I don't, fortunately, I'm not part of a big law firm here in Maine, but I don't think we've seen anything directly impacted the law firms, the big law firms here in Maine. But I certainly can see how these kinds of actions and orders can put a chilling effect on lawyers, on who they choose to represent, on which cases they choose to move forward with, and even just on expressing their views.
An email here from Peter. Can the panel explain what judge shopping refers to? And I'm trying to remember which of you said this. The friends, Dimitri, go ahead.
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier. So during the Biden administration, for example, there are districts in the United States that only have one judge. And so if you go to that district, you file a case in that district court, you know for certain who that judge will be and their political ideology, right? So if you want to stop the president's agenda, you can find a district court where you can file a case. And many of these cases can really be filed anywhere because they're nationwide issues. They impact somebody everywhere. So as long as I find the right plaintiff, you file a case in that district. You're guaranteed a certain judge who might be really favorable to your views or really unfavorable to the president's views and can issue an order stopping the president from acting anywhere in the country. So that's kind of the concern about the nationwide injunctions that we've seen really talked about for many administrations now. This is not a new issue. It's just if the president, you like his power, you really don't like the nationwide injunctions. If somebody you don't like his power, you might be okay with them, right? So this is why it's been kind of boiling up, and people on the left and the right have sometimes taken different positions on whether or not they like nationwide injunctions or not.
All right, and Dimitri, why don't you give us a little bit of a primer? What is a district court?
Yeah, district court is the lowest level of the federal justice system, right? So the United States Constitution sets up the U.S. Supreme Court, and then Congress came in and established lower courts. So there's a federal district courts. That's where you file the initial lawsuit. That's where most trials are held. If you watch, movies about trials and witnesses taking place and juries, that takes place in the district court. If somebody loses the district court, they can appeal that case to a circuit court, which is a court of appeals, the intermediate court. And then if you lose there, you can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And most states have that structure as well. Maine's actually an exception. We have two levels. We have trial courts, which are district courts, superior courts, and then the law court, the Supreme Judicial Court. So we don't have an intermediate appellate court, but most states actually mirror the federal system with three levels of courts, a trial court, an intermediate appellate court, and then the state Supreme Court.
We have an
Jennifer, I
email here
think
from,
Peter's.
oh yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I just want to add one thing. Peter's question is a good one, and it gets at this one issue, which is troubling, and that is our judicial branch, the way we refer to them, are now becoming more and more common to refer to them as Republican judges or Democratic judges, appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic. And what has become this judicial shopping is all contributing to this idea that the judiciary has become partisan, and we can predict based on their partisan affiliation or which party appointed them and confirmed them as judges as to which way they're going to lean. And it's a very troubling development when we cling to the hope that all of these judges are calling the balls and strikes the same way because they are judges and looking at the facts and the law.
I have an email here from Bill. Where are the opposing views on this show? Can your current guests speak to this? So I'm going to go back to you, Bill, but I want to ask you about this. If you were to listen to three of you, you would think that there is near unanimity among the legal profession that the rule of law is at risk. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we hear this a lot, that this shouldn't be a partisan issue. We shouldn't be attacking the president or the Republican Party. And that's true, but this is not a partisan issue. This is a core democratic principle that all of us, Republicans, Democrats, rich, poor, old, young, should all be concerned about. And there really isn't another side to that issue upholding our basic role of judges and lawyers in our democracy.
And to your
Yeah,
point, Bill, and I'll turn to you, Dimitri, Chief Justice John Roberts is one of those who is right into this conversation. Dimitri?
well, just a couple little things. So, were you the question you're asking, Jennifer, and maybe this echoes something that Bill said about do we have Republican judges, Democratic judges? Certainly, John Roberts has said no, we shouldn't have Trump judges and Obama judges call balls and strikes. I think the evidence is somewhat to the contrary, where you have fairly predictable decisions, not only by the U.S. Supreme Court, but some of these district court judges. And there's a reason why, to stop the Biden administration, all these lawsuits were filed in the Northern District of Texas, and there was a certain judge that was a judge there in Amarillo. And basically, you knew that if you went to that judge, you'd likely be able to prevail against the Biden administration. So I do think at least recent history has borne out that many judges are deciding cases along party lines pretty predictably. The one piece I would add to something that Bill was saying earlier about the rule of law, I agree that since probably 1803, since Marbury versus Madison, we have said the court decides what the law is, what the Constitution means, and people follow it. I would say there have been a couple of minor exceptions, right? So Andrew Jackson, maybe apocryphally, said Judge Marshall made his decision, not let him enforce it. Lincoln kind of flirted after the Dred Scott decision, saying, "Well, that applies to these parties, but maybe not nationwide." So there have been some instances in this country history where the presidents have tried to push back against the Supreme Court. There's this idea of departmentalism, where maybe every branch has its own say about what the Constitution means. So there's at least some tradition of resisting the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that you really disagree with. Ultimately, those have been worked out and have never led to a constitutional crisis that is potentially at risk here.
And Susan.
I mean, I don't think the rule of law issue is a political issue. It's again, it's an, it's this concept of using the law, arguing, advocating for the law, having that go through the court system, and when the court system issues a decision, respecting that decision, not calling judges out because you don't like the decision and calling them corrupt. Or or making other accusations about the judge just because you don't like the legal ruling. It's the idea that we are going to use the court systems, we're going to respect that system, and that's the avenue that we're going to pursue to get our legal issues resolved.
Let me ask you the big question though, is the court system indeed as pure as Bill, you're smiling. I as those who are defending it would like to make it out to be.
I don't know if I'd use the word pure, that we're all human. We all have potential to be wrong, and there are frailties and that come into play. But I think what you're hearing and what we learned as lawyers in law school and are trained is that we respect the judges' rulings, and they're not all perfect, but they are the law of the land. And it's really important that our citizens and our clients understand that when they go into a courtroom and they lose, they have to have the confidence they got a fair shake and that the judge gave the consideration to their perspective. If that starts to break down, we have got big problems, because we know that in every case, one party is going to lose while the other wins. The losing party has to accept that ruling and move on. And if we can't do that because the system is broken down and become so adversarial, partisan, whatever, then we really have a constitutional crisis and our democracy is at risk.
We'll go to Fred, who's calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Fred, go ahead.
Hey, thank you for the program. Really great. What caught my attention yesterday was Christine Noem saying or expressing that she didn't know what the heck habeas corpus was. And I think that's a real statement about what's going on and what isn't going on in Washington, D.C. right now.
Fred, thank you for your call. Dimitri, thoughts about what Fred's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think habeas is a concept that goes back to the Magna Carta, right? It's the idea that there is a process that you follow, and this is kind of one of the most important individual rights, right? That you have, if you're being arrested, if you're being detained, there has to be a reason why you're being detained. There's a process that you go through the court to convince the judge that there's a reason to hold you in custody, right? And so you've seen challenges to that idea. You've seen Stephen Miller and the president maybe considering eliminating habeas corpus. Because of an invasion, right, which is an exception to the Constitution. That's something we really haven't seen in this country's history. I mean, certainly during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln tried to suspend habeas corpus because Congress wasn't in session at the time. Ultimately, Congress ratified his actions. That's not what we're dealing with here, right? So I think kind of stretching the meaning of invasion in the Constitution, trying to go around Congress, where again, we've had a centuries-old understanding that it's likely Congress who can suspend habeas corpus during an invasion or an attack. That's not what's happening today. So I think this kind of division of separation of powers, that's maybe a key piece that's lacking here when the president is acting, the administrative branch is acting without any input or a check by the Senate or the House.
Mary on
Yeah, Jennifer,
Facebook.
let me
Oh
just
yeah,
say
go ahead,
quickly
Bill.
that,
Yeah.
that there should be no question about what habeas corpus is. It is a critical piece of our democracy, and the listeners should understand at its core, it means that a government official cannot come and take you off the streets and put you in jail without some process. And that is critical and different from many authoritarian governments in which government simply has the ability to round up people who are unpopular or disfavored and never to be heard from again. There should be no question about how important habeas corpus is to our system.
Mary on Facebook writes, "We are counting on you, attorneys." The chief executive says, "Of course, he'll honor judicial decisions until he doesn't, because he disagrees with them." It's appalling. What's a poor working stiff to do? And I'm wondering, Susan, if you and others, other attorneys, are feeling the weight of the moment.
Yes, certainly. And you know, I like I said, you know, I think it's at all levels. Just thinking within the state, I'm thinking about the attorneys that work for the Attorney General's office. I'm thinking about the attorneys that work for the legal services here in Maine, whether that's through the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project or Pine Tree Legal or Volunteer Lawyers Project. There's all these individuals who are being directly impacted by these measures. And we already have a system where attorneys are very busy, they're overworked. The attorneys in Maine are very generous with their time in terms of pro bono services and volunteering their time. And I worry as we move forward that the demand is going to be much higher than what attorneys can give. So we're doing our best. But there is certainly a lot of work, and we are certainly being pulled in many different directions.
Dimitri.
And one thing I'd add to kind of the case that Susan mentioned earlier about nationwide injunctions, certainly if the court weakens the nationwide injunction, then you would need a lawyer to bring all of these cases, right? So right now you can rely on one case, almost like a class action, and that decides the issue nationwide. If the court says no, you really need, every district or every plaintiff to bring their own case, then you need an army of lawyers to bring all these individual lawsuits that are not maybe decided by one. And so that I think makes it even more difficult for lawyers to take on all of these issues.
Susan.
And just to add on to that, I mean, when you think about like these legal service organizations, even in Maine, who have lost funding, again, because of federal funding, they've lost federal funding. We're already a state that has limited resources. And there's this external pressure about, is the government going to come in and dictate about which cases we can or cannot take, or will they, issue some parameters around that. All of that hinders lawyers' ability to represent clients, and that is what I'm saying. There's more need for people to bring their cases forward and to appeal their cases. So I think that's why the Trump versus Casa case is a really important one to be watching right now.
Bill, when I read Mary's email, or excuse me, Facebook post, I was remembering the last time Senator King was on Maine Calling. He was asked by one of our listeners what
people in Congress were saying, colleagues for other U.S. senators were saying behind closed doors. And he said many are saying we're depending on the courts. The courts will fix this. And he was very frustrated with that. He said, wait a minute, we can't depend on the courts to fix everything. What do you think?
I think he's right. I mean, I think the courts are critical. Lawyers and judges are our first line of defense, but we need Congress to step up and play its role. One of the reasons why this is where we are today is because Congress has essentially stepped back and let the president with executive orders dictate the policy. We need Congress, and we need all of us to join together, and stand firm. We need all citizens who are concerned about the future of the democracy and the constitutional crisis to join through local, strengthen local institutions, state institutions, to uphold the rule of law and to hold our democracy together. It's going to take all hands on deck, everyone doing their fair share to get us out of this.
We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about the rule of law. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing the issue referred to as the rule of law and what cases before the Supreme Court or working their way through the court system right now will mean for democracy. My guest right now, Bill Harwood, former Maine public advocate who is now helping organize Maine attorneys to support the rule of law. Susan Fonts is president of the Maine State Bar Association and an attorney herself. And Dimitri Baum is vice dean and provost at Maine Law. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to David calling from Fairfield right now. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to clarify, in a lot of these debates, you know, obviously, like listening, I'm thinking to myself, of course, we can't suspend habeas corpus. And whether or not to imply it's right or wrong, the conclusion to what I'm going to ask, where is this conversation focusing on how do we apply these constitutional rights to non-citizens? Because I feel like that's sort of the angle from the Trump administration, unless I'm wrong. And sort of that seems to be the tough debate. Yes?
Yeah, David, excellent question. Dimitri, I'm turning to you for this one.
Well, so some rights are basically stated in an absolute, and so they apply to kind of anybody subject to U.S. jurisdiction, right? So you go to U.S. court, if the U.S. takes custody of someone, the rights apply. You know, we've had these cases involving Guantanamo post 9/11, where the court said even detainees held in Guantanamo, certain due process rights apply to those individuals, and habeas applies to those individuals. So at least due process and habeas, we know applies even to alleged enemy combatants held in Guantanamo Bay. Some rights are a little bit less clear, right? So there's maybe less certainty to what extent some free speech protections apply to certain immigrants, right? So I think it's really clause by clause. I think with habeas, it is fairly clear. I think some voting rights are more limited if you're not in the country lawfully or if you're non-resident of a state, right? So you really have to look at the clauses, specific clauses, and some of the kind of case law on those particular issues.
David, thank you so much for your question. We'll go to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guest. There are two things that indicate to me that Trump has already won. Clearest, most obvious one is an infinite supply of pens, and he can just flood the airwaves and all aspects of our lives with executive orders. There aren't enough lawyers and courts, and especially the timing of it. He's a chaos president. That's all he wants out of this, just chaos and dysfunction, so he can just go ahead and he and his minions do what they want to do. The second one is, how can we call ourselves a democracy in spite of the heroics of the Pine Tree Legal and all the rest of them when we will not adequately fund
Torbert?
Yes, when we won't adequately fund the Gideon representation right. Everybody gets a lawyer, but there's no money for it.
And Susan Torbert's talking about something that's also a very big issue when we're talking about the legal profession here in Maine, which is similar but not exactly the same, and that is the lack of representation for many, both civil and criminal defendants here in Maine right now.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously is a big issue, as you said, both in the civil realm and in the criminal realm. It's just a matter of not having enough attorneys with enough time for the demands that we have. I don't know how to resolve that issue. Certainly, the Maine State Bar Association has been closely watching both of those issues, and we've been following any sort of legislative efforts to help with those issues. But that's just the state of where we're at right now. Maybe with the influx of law school applicants, we'll see the tides turning, but obviously that will take some time, and there's a lot of immediate work to be done.
Jennifer, Herbert has put his finger on another really important issue related to the rule of law. We cannot let our courtrooms and courthouses be exclusively available to the wealthy and privileged and powerful. Every citizen has their right to their day in court, and the lawyers in this country hold the keys to the courthouse. We have got to continue to find ways through appropriations at the state and federal level, and through pro bono work of private lawyers, to make sure that we never get to the point where justice is only available to those who can afford expensive lawyers.
We'll go to this email from Sandy. Could you discuss what a constitutional crisis actually is? There's so much emphasis that we're in one, which I believe we are, but please define what that means. Dimitri.
Well, so I think people can have different meanings for different terms, including rule of law, right? So I think people can define it different ways. I think for a lot of people, constitutional crisis would happen when the branches clashed in a way that really was not thought of either at the founding or we would have no experience with, right? So that's why I think many people refer to a president ignoring a Supreme Court order as a potential crisis, right? So even though in the past there have been some kind of maybe hesitation to enforce court orders, ultimately the presidents have always done so. And if the president says, look, I'm just not going to listen to what you said, then you've got two branches at a conflict that's almost irresolvable, right? The court is the least dangerous branch, in the words of Hamilton. They don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword, right? There's no army that Justice Roberts or any of the justices have to enforce their orders. And so the system is really built on the individuals that are in it, right? And the good faith of the people that are in it. And the president says, look, I've got the army and I don't care what you say, then you've got a potential conflict. Now, is that a crisis? Arguably. Now, is there a solution? Maybe there's a political solution, right? You vote somebody out of office. Maybe Congress at that point steps in and says, you know what, we've been dormant for a little while, but we will step in now and use the impeachment process, right? But I think relying on Congress today is pretty difficult when they've been very deferential to the president. And so I think that's the crisis, the nature of the crisis, that you have a disagreement between the branches that has not happened in this nation's history.
We'll go to Heidi, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Heidi, go ahead.
Hello there. Thank you for having this program. I've been almost getting a law degree myself from trying to understand everything that's been happening in rapid speed. I shouldn't say a law degree, but I was. There's so much to talk about with this subject, so forgive me for probably being a little bit all over the place. Because that last comment about being in a constitutional crisis, I feel like we are already there. And first, I wanted to say there's been some really good sources online that have been helpful, Legal AF, and then there's Mark Elias, which the president has called out by name because he's, fights for democracy. Brian Tyler Cohen also having a lot of shows with Mark Elias to really kind of break down what are the courts doing? What are the steps that are being taken? And what I wonder, because this whole thing where the court does not have any protection for citizens, we don't have an army, we don't have control of the army. And right now I feel like we're kind of sitting ducks if we don't somehow push the envelope. And maybe your panelists could tell me, because I feel like I've heard that police officers could be deputized, that when you don't have an army, but you need some sort of force, because
when you say, again, could police officers be deputized by the Supreme Court?
By the court. Is that a real thing, or is that just something?
Yeah, so you have a bunch of confused looking, not confused. I don't want to characterize your face, but we don't have people nodding in agreement right now. Dimitri, what do you think of Heidi's question?
Well, I mean, obviously the court has powers of contempt. They've got their own marshals, right? So there's some very limited power and authority, but not to the point where it can stand up to the president and force the president to enforce the law, right? So even if a court were to find the president or an executive branch official in contempt, likely the president could pardon that individual, right, and not make them enforce the order. So I think the powers of the court are so limited as to not really count when it comes to the executive branch's vast authority.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Heidi, for your question. From Bruce, an email. It's a Maine rule of law question. Is Governor Mills' stance on trans athletes an opinion or a ruling, or does our Constitution actually state what she is saying? Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think Governor Mills is absolutely upholding the rule of law. We can discuss politically what the rights of trans athletes should be, but the governor has made it very clear that she will follow the rules adopted by the Maine legislature. They are very clear on this issue. And she will, as the governor, uphold that rule of law unless and until either the legislature changes the law or some judge interprets it differently from the governor. So I think, regardless of where you stand on that political issue, I think we all need to appreciate and respect for the governor for standing up for the rule of law on this issue.
All right, here's an email from Bob. Regarding the perceived asymmetry of immigration law, please explain why hundreds or thousands or even millions of individuals can walk into the United States in a facilitated fashion, apparently counter to existing law, and yet those same people can only be escorted back out of the country after a long and cumbersome legal process. Ordinary people want to know why this makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an immigration law expert, right? But certainly it's a complicated field, right? So I think part of the problem when you're talking about kind of mass migration, when it's somebody entering illegally, is resources, right? So I think if the previous administrations, you know, put in place resources to stop some of the mass migration, it likely would address some of the issues here, right? But as far as kind of deportation and taking people out, that's where the habeas issue fits in, right? You want to ensure that if somebody's being removed from the country, that there's a lawful authority for their removal, right? You might have missed them when they came in for whatever reason, whether it's an asylum or for some other reason, but there's a process that we have, and it's written in the law that you follow before somebody can be deported, and you don't want to make a mistake on that issue, right? So just because previously there was maybe a mistake in letting somebody in or not devoting sufficient resources to protecting the border doesn't mean that now you can kind of ignore other provisions of the Constitution to get people out.
And I think that, Jennifer, it's important that your listeners understand this immigration issue comes in a lot of different varieties. We have some who are here and they are waiting for their day in court to claim asylum, and that those people have certain rights and expectations. We also have people who are born to those people who are come in. And now we have the president saying they're not U.S. citizens, contrary to the Constitution. And finally, remember that many of those people that were referred to in the question have been living in this country, working hard, have not committed any crimes, paying their taxes. And at some point, we owe them their day in court before they're deported.
An email here from Butch. Your guest called Andrew Jackson's refusal to uphold the Supreme Court's decision a minor one. The removal of Native American people from the South on the Trail of Tears was not a minor act. Thousands of Native people died because Jackson refused to accept the court's decision. Don't try to play down this terrible act in U.S. history. And Dimitri, I don't believe you were trying to play it down, correct?
No, I just meant in terms of, I think it's an apocryphal statement. I think most people who have studied Andrew Jackson actually don't think he said this. So it's unclear what he actually said. But I just meant in terms of there's no real history of resistance of the president of saying, I will not follow the court's orders. There's a statement that's out there, but not actually saying, you said one thing, but I will do something entirely different.
All right. Well, I really appreciate all of you, and I apologize to all of you who had questions we were not able to get to, but we are out of time. The voice you just heard, Dimitri Baum, who is from the UMaine Law School, Susan Fonts is head of the Bar Association in Maine, and Bill Harwood, you know his voice, former public advocate for the state of Maine and leading a group of lawyers who are advocating for the rule of law. Thank you all so much for being with us. Maine Calling's sound engineer today was Chris Bridges. As always, the show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.